From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
Well, what we really wanted to do is talk to young people and talk to their parents and talk to people in the school to figure out how they were making sense of what was going on. You know, one of the things we had heard so often in the research and people's sort of common discourse, and even in what we hear from President Obama and the First Lady, is this idea that black kids don't care about education. And what we in part wanted to do is figure out, you know, what was going on around that sort of argument. And what we found is that that really wasn't the case, that when we talked to black, white, and Latino kids, they all had pretty similar ideas about education. They were all pretty invested in it. But what we also found in our conversations with people and in our survey of 15 school districts.
Dr. John B. Diamond, professor of education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Education and co-author of Despite the Best Intentions, published by Oxford University Press. On the surface, Riverview High School looked like any other Midwest suburban high school. The school serves an affluent, diverse, and liberal district. The school is well-funded, its teachers are well-trained, and many of its students are high-achieving. Yet, Riverview has not escaped the same unrelenting question that plagues schools throughout America. Why is it that even when all the circumstances seem right, black and Latino students continue to lag behind their peers? Diamond first started taking a closer look at this topic in 2003, while working as a research director for the Minority Student Achievement Network. A principal had asked him to look into why so many African-American boys in this particular school were struggling. What made this problem so puzzling was the fact that these African-American students were lagging behind their peers, even at a place that on the surface appeared to have plenty going for it. I'm John L. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Despite the Best Intentions, with co-author Dr. John B. Diamond, In Black America.
I think it goes back to the idea that race has been constructed as a way, it's been socially constructed as a way to ensure that some people are seen as superior and others are seen as inferior. So it's, you know, it became codified into the way that we think about people, you know, to justify slavery, colonialism, Native American genocide. And so there's, you know, certainly this history. For blacks, it's often been about criminality and lack of intelligence, that race has been associated with that for African Americans. For whites, it's always been the assumption of innocence and intellectual ability. And so that doesn't necessarily go away just because times change. What we found is that many people in the school, from teachers, administrators to students, talked about the fact that black students were often given subtle messages that they weren't capable of achieving.
In an effort to bring a better understanding regarding the achievement gap between African American, Latino, Asian, and white students, Dr. John B. Diamond and co-author Amanda E. Lewis conducted an in-depth study with far-reaching consequences. Despite the Best Intention revolutionized our clarity of both the knotty problem of academic disparities and the larger question of color line in American society. As students progressed from elementary to middle to high school, their level of academic achievement increasingly tracked along racial lines, with white and Asian students maintaining higher GPAs and standardized test scores, taking more advanced classes and obtaining better college admission results than their African-American and Latino counterparts. Most research to date has focused on the role of poverty, family stability, and other external influence in examining poor performances at school, especially in urban contexts. Diamond and Lewis instead situated their research in a suburban school and looked at what factors within the school itself could be causing the disparity.
What I try to do is understand education as it's a part of society as a whole. So I'm trying to understand not just the day-to-day, what happens in the classroom, but how that connects to broader issues. And for me, those issues are around race, social class, gender, and sort of the social context in which schools exist. So it's more about what happens in society as a whole and how education and schools are related to that.
Speaking of education and society, I'm quite sure you're well aware of what transpired up in Irving, Texas, with the young student bringing a clock to school, and he was thought to be bringing a hoax bomb. Any comments regarding that?
Yeah, I think it demonstrates the need for people to understand that their biases can really shape how they treat people and interact with people. It seems to me that based on what I've heard, they didn't really even think that it was a bomb. They thought it was a hoax. And I think it's, you know, it tells us a lot about people's perceptions of Muslims, of young kids of color and how that can influence how they're treated. It clearly to me was unnecessary and inappropriate.
How did you and Amanda Lewis come together to write this book?
Amanda and I had known each other for about 5 years before we started working on the project together. And we were both sociologists of education. Amanda and I had similar backgrounds in terms of the things we were interested in. And so I was approached by someone in the school who was concerned about what was going on with black boys in particular in this racially diverse high school. And he asked me to interview some of those students. And what wound up happening is I had Amanda join in on the project, and we wound up interviewing 170 people, including students, parents, teachers, and administrators from the school and community, to try to figure out what was really happening around race in this particular context.
Did Mr. Weber come to you all, or you saw
him out?
Okay.
He did. He came to us, and we both knew him. I had been working with him for a while, and he said, you know, I'm really nearing the end of my career, and I've been working on trying to figure out this problem for a long time. Can you help me?
Some interesting information did come out from you all's research, but prior to you all actually going into this particular endeavor, what are some of the things that you all thought out beforehand to try to evaluate during this process?
Well, what we really wanted to do is talk to young people and talk to their parents and talk to people in the school to figure out how they were making sense of what was going on. You know, one of the things we had heard so often in the research and people's sort of common discourse, and even what we hear from President Obama and the First Lady, is this idea that black kids don't care about education. And what we in part wanted to do is figure out, you know, what was going on around that sort of argument. And what we found is that that really wasn't the case, that when we talked to black, white, and Latino kids, they all had pretty similar ideas about education. They were all pretty invested in it. But what we also found in our conversations with people and in our survey of 15 school districts was that black students are actually more pro-school than their white counterparts. They actually wanted to go further in school. They got more positive feedback from their peers. When they were struggling, they got more encouragement to do more work. And so we started with, you know, trying to understand if that phenomenon was happening. And once we were able to figure out that that wasn't what was going on, then we started exploring some of the other things that we thought would matter.
It was interesting in reading the book. Most of the parents of students that attend the school, that's Riverview, were attending that school and living in that community because of its diversity. But once one goes into the school, there's a internal segregation of the students based by their academic achievement. Explain to us how this particular phenomenon took place.
Right. So what was the school was made up of about 47% white students, about 35% black students, about 8.5% Latino students, and the rest were Asian, Native American, and, you know, other biracial students. And what wound up happening is, you know, as you said, people moved to this community because they were very interested in being in a diverse community. It was a suburban school context, well-resourced, with predominantly middle-class families in the community. What wound up happening in school, though, is that once kids came into the high school, they socialized with each other outside of class, but when they went into the classrooms, they were going into different spaces. So the honors level and the advanced placement level, which were considered the higher level classes, were 80 to 90% white in a school that was less than 50% white overall. And mm-hmm. So black and Latino students tended to be concentrated in the lower levels. And part of the way this happened was through test scores and other kinds of indicators, but it was also the ways in which teachers determined and decided to recommend kids for higher level classes, the ways that they responded to parents who tried to intervene in the process. So parents could override the teachers' and administrators' decisions, but when white parents sought to override those decisions, they were greeted with support. When black students and Latino students, or black parents and Latino parents tried to intervene, they were more likely to be told no or faced a lot more resistance. It was much more of a struggle. So those were some of the ways that the diverse school became less diverse when it came to who was in what class and what classrooms.
Now, you all use some interesting terms throughout the book, and we're going to go through a few of them. Oppositional culture, or acting white hypothesis.
Right. So the acting white hypothesis is generated from Signithia Fordham and John Ogbu's work, where they argue that because black people experience discrimination in the society and in the schools, that their peer groups tend to be anti-school, that peers will accuse their peers who try to engage in school-related activities that lead to success, will accuse them of acting white. What the research shows, however, is that's really not the case. There's work out there by people like Angel Harris, mm-hmm. Carolyn Tyson, and our book that shows that when you look at the data, black students and parents tend to be as invested or more invested in school than their white counterparts. And so this idea of oppositional culture has far outlived the empirical support for the idea, and our book is another example of how that phenomenon has become a myth that won't go away, even though the data doesn't support it.
Another term, popularity penalty.
Yeah, that's work by Roland Fryer, who's a Harvard economist. He's looked at this. What he tried to do is figure out if students became less popular as they did better in school. And what the popularity penalty suggests is that black students who achieve at a 3.5 or higher on a 4-point scale tend to have fewer friends than their white counterparts. One of the things that we know from thinking about that work, however, is that this pattern doesn't exist in schools that are predominantly African American. Mm. It doesn't exist in non-public schools. So it only exists in schools where black students are in the minority, which suggests to us that the popularity penalty is much more about the isolation that comes structurally from the school than it has to do with black culture itself. So that's just one example of research that's out there that people suggest supports oppositional culture that we really don't think does.
I found interesting that you all wrote that what happens outside in the community and society somewhat mirrors what goes on in our schools.
That's definitely true. One of the things that we found is that black male students in particular, but black students and Latino students found themselves sort of hyper-surveilled or policed in the context of the school. So when they violated rules, they were much more likely to be punished for those violations than their white counterparts. One example of that is students had to have a hallway pass when they walked through the halls at Riverview during class periods. What we found is that black students were much more likely to be stopped and asked for those hall passes than their white counterparts. And this was recognized by white students. There was a white girl, for example, who talked about the fact that it was really unfair that everyone assumed she was just a white girl who was following the rules, but would always stop black students and Latino students, ask them for a hall pass, and then punish them if they didn't have them. And so this was one example of how, you know, it sort of mirrors what happens with racial profiling outside of the school, where you have sort of the hyper-policing in black communities. And, you know, the likelihood of being caught in violation of a rule goes up exponentially when you're mm-hmm. the ones who are being stopped.
It was interesting in reading that Anglo students, from a teacher perspective, was automatically smarter than other students in the school just for their race.
Right. And I think it goes back to the idea that race has been constructed as a way, it's been socially constructed as a way to ensure that some people are seen as superior and others are seen as inferior. So, it's, you know, it became codified into the way that we think about people, you know, to justify slavery, colonialism, Native American genocide. And so there's, you know, certainly this history. For blacks, it's often been about criminality and lack of intelligence. That race has been associated with that for African Americans. For whites, it's always been the assumption of innocence and intellectual ability. And so that doesn't necessarily go away just because times change. Mm-hmm. What we found is that many people in the school, from teachers, administrators to students, talked about the fact that black students were often given subtle messages that they weren't capable of achieving. And so the students would say, black students would say, you know, I always have to do twice as much to get rewarded for it. It's really hard for me to be rewarded for my academic ability, and people don't expect me to do very well. Whereas white students would say things like they felt that they were always assumed to be smarter, assumed to do better, and believed to be more intelligent than their black peers. And so that reinforces white supremacy, and it leads to a situation where black students have to overcome the negative expectations that people hold for them.
I understand. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. We're speaking with Dr. John B. Diamond, Associate Professor of Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Education and co-author of Despite the Best Intentions. Dr. Diamond, I found it interesting in as that most of the teachers, by and large, felt that they were treating students fairly, but that was not so the case in the long term.
Yes. I mean, I think what was interesting and what, you know, I was really in some ways surprised by is the fact that while people said they were doing their best to treat people fairly and equitably, upon, you know, further reflection, they oftentimes said, well, but I think students aren't necessarily treated completely the same. And so one of the things that we recognize and the research on race shows is that race is one of the first things that people notice when someone walks into a room.
Right.
And that cultural baggage and that historical baggage that I talked about before is something that permeates the way we interact with people, even subconsciously. So people who have good intentions and believe in equitable treatment can sometimes engage in practices that don't communicate that to people when they interact with them. It happens when people are working in small groups. It happens when those kids are walking down the hallway and some are assumed to be innocent and some are assumed to be guilty. It happens when, for example, Black students were sometimes walking into a classroom for honors and AP class and have had teachers in the school in Riverview say, well, I think you're in the wrong place. This is not the class for you, even though the student was in the right place. They just weren't accustomed to seeing Blackness and intelligence in the same body. So I think there are ways in which even our beliefs defy us because of the subconscious way that race creeps into our understanding and our action.
Also, as you say that, as far as the educators and administrators are concerned, there was some ostracism going on between the students themselves when, say, an African-American goes into an AP algebra or calculus class, and they're the only minority in the room.
Right. And I think, you know, that again, is part of that subtle process of people weren't used to seeing Blackness or Latinoness and intelligence in the same body. So one Latina girl named Maria said to us that one of the things that happened to her is that she would come into her ninth grade biology class that was an honors class, and the white girls would form study groups and exclude her from the study group, and that she would get these looks in the classroom that suggested that her and the other Mexican-American students weren't as intelligent as the white students. So there are ways in which those kinds of biases creeped into the student interaction and engagement in a way that, you know, the peer culture sort of worked against the success of Black and Latino students in the context of those classes.
Obviously, this tracking doesn't occur when they get to high school. So during the process from elementary to middle school, what's taking place to get these African-American or minority students in the track that they're only taking, by and large, the basics?
Well, I mean, I think there are, now while we were studying a place that's predominantly middle class in terms of income, class among African Americans, Latinos, in comparison to whites, is not actually the same. So whites tend to, at the same social class level, have a lot more wealth and a lot more resources to draw on. And so in a lot of ways, they're piling those resources onto their kids and using that leverage of their social class background and the expectations of intelligence, the parents are, to get advantages for their kids. So in some ways, you know, the sort of cumulative effect of that can lead to differences in preparation for people that are reinforced by those sort of subtle interactional dynamics that I was talking about before. So that's part of it. But I think the other piece is, for every year and every class and every moment and every interaction in which people communicate low expectations to some students and high expectations to others, there becomes a widening of the gap, the widening of opportunity gaps that exist for young people. And I think the cumulative effect of that is that by the time people get to high school, the cumulative impact is that they're in sort of different places and therefore have had different access to resources and then wind up getting different educational opportunities in high school.
You all also write about students and their teachers as far as maybe not the most experienced teachers are teaching these minority students, and they're not getting the same level of education as their counterparts.
Right. So the national research shows that Black and Latino students typically get teachers who are younger and less highly qualified than their white counterparts. And we know from research that teachers improve quite a bit in the first 3 to 5 years that they are teaching. And so what winds up happening is that nationally, Black students are and Latino students are getting taught by teachers with less who are less well prepared and less experienced than their white counterparts. What happens in the context of schools like Riverview, where you have a racial mix, the teachers who are teaching the honors and AP classes tend to be tracked, in a sense, with the students who have performed well previously. And so what winds up happening there is you get the newer teacher, less experienced teacher, with the predominantly Black and Latino kids in the lower level classes, and the more experienced, more highly qualified teacher teaching the upper level classes. So again, that's another way in which educational quality is undermined for the majority of our Black and Latino young people.
Now, obviously, there was a diverse administrative and teaching staff at Riverview. So how were the minority teachers navigating this culture, seeing the things that they see happening to other minority students?
This is one of the things that really helped us understand the power of what we call opportunity hoarding.
Right.
And opportunity hoarding is when people with more resources try to monopolize those resources and keep access to them for their own kids and keep it away from other kids.
Mm-hmm.
And so one Black administrator said to us that one of the things that she noticed among the teachers is, and even African-American teachers, is that there were times when they would see a white student struggle and they would be more quick to intervene on behalf of that white student because they anticipated that the white parent with more resources was going to give them problems if they didn't, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there became this subtle process of believing that, you know, a white student who was getting a C and a Black student who was getting a C, the white student would get intervention more quickly because they anticipated, the teacher anticipated that that parent, that white parent would be more involved. Part of the story for us around opportunity hoarding is that anytime the school tried to make interventions to create more equitable classrooms and more equitable spaces, there was always the threat of intervention on the part of the elite sort of white parents in the district and some middle-class African-Americans, but predominantly white parents who were working against those kinds of interventions. And those led to processes like white parents migrating away from classes that were mixed level, that included honors students and regular students in the same class when they tried to detract. So there was a process we called internal white flight, where white parents were sort of creating all white spaces by moving their kids from studying things like that they wanted to study, like Africa, their white kids from those spaces and sending them to study, for example, Russia or the Middle East, where they were mostly white students. So there were these processes that when administrators and teachers who had the best intentions tried to change things, they ran into this force that was working against them and resisting those changes.
I found it interesting that some of the students that you spoke with weren't all that excited and thrilled about taking honors or AP courses, but was steered and prodded by their parents and the teachers to, you know, to give it a try and don't give up. On the other side, I was interested in you all's narrative about basically white privilege, where students go in automatically knowing that, one, they're going to get the best teachers. Secondly, that is almost a foregone conclusion that at the end of high school, they're going to go to college and one of the elite colleges at that.
Right, right. And it you know, sort of this complicated process, or in some ways very straightforward process, of the school sort of reinforcing those narratives, reinforcing the idea that, well, some kids deserve to be understood, deserve to be given the benefit of the doubt because they have a bright future. And that was the sort of narrative about white students, whereas Black students and Latino students were often not necessarily seen in the same light and not seen as having the same potential or expected to lead the same future in terms of going to college and going to four-year elite colleges. So that was definitely a dynamic that we saw in the school and one of the things that we think needs to be changed if we want to make educational outcomes more equal across race.
During this process, did you all have an aha moment?
You know, what was interesting is I think the biggest aha moment was actually being able to hear from such a wide range of people that they recognized the problem.
Okay.
Now, this district had been working on race and achievement for some time, but we were surprised on some level how much the white students could see how the black students were being mistreated in some ways, how black, Latino, and white students recognized similar patterns, how teachers and administrators, black and white, saw these inequalities playing out and were felt in some ways like there wasn't a whole lot they could do to make a difference given that there was this opportunity hoarding process going on. So I think for me, you know, I thought we would hear more disparate stories across people, but the stories tended to be relatively similar. People were recognizing these patterns, but also feeling like they weren't quite sure how to change it.
How did the parents reconcile, on one end, you know, wanting to live in this diverse community, and then on the other end of allowing the segregation of their children once they get to school?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's about the, you know, what is the commitment to actual integration, diversity,
okay, right,
and equal opportunity? You know, on some level, they were committed to it on its surface, and I think they had a deeply held commitment to it. But there was this idea that it was a zero-sum game, that if everyone was given equal opportunity, then someone was going to lose. And I think
right,
what the parents were seemed to be concerned about is, well, what does this mean for my child in this competition, you know, for elite colleges and for, you know, their future? They had a commitment to diversity, but it was a relatively shallow commitment to diversity.
Once all this has taken place and you all submitted the information to Riverview, what changes took place?
Well, I mean, one of the exciting things about this kind of work is, you know, that I'm actually using the data from the book to build a partnership with the Madison Public Schools now,
mm-hmm,
which is a district that's relatively similar to Riverview, where we're sort of engaging around some of the issues in the book to make a difference, changing some of the policies and practices. One of the things that districts like Riverview have done, based on some of the work that we've done in our conversations and other people's desire to see change, is they've created honors opportunities for people that are based on earning honors credits so that more students get the opportunity to demonstrate that they're capable of doing honors level work rather than just being placed in there by a test.
Dr. John B. Diamond, professor of education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Education and co-author of Despite the Best Intentions. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future in Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm John L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.